And our next case this morning is United States versus Michael Jackson. Case number 11-1321. Ms. Christensen.
May it please the Court, Counsel. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Joanna Christensen, and I represent the appellant Michael Jackson in this case. The issue before the Court is one of relevant conduct. Two types of drug amounts that were included in Mr. Jackson's relevant conduct. The first being the 510 grams of crack cocaine that was included based on controlled buys from Demetrius Brown before Mr. Jackson was involved in this conspiracy. And the second being the 42 kilograms of powder cocaine seized in the two cars that drove away from the last distribution of 3 kilograms of cocaine to Mr. Jackson's conspiracy. Both of these were included, and they were not reasonably foreseeable to Mr. Jackson, and particularly the 42 kilograms of powder cocaine were not in furtherance of his jointly undertaken criminal activity. The actions of co-conspirators that he did not assist or agree to promote are generally not within the jointly undertaken criminal activity. First, the 510 grams of crack cocaine. All of these controlled buys happened before Mr. Jackson was involved and even known to the investigation.
How do we know that? I thought are you treating as the dates of his involvement only the dates from which there are telephone intercepts involving him?
Well, that's really the only evidence that he was involved. The investigators didn't know.
Well, there's also his statements about having been involved since he came to Indianapolis in 2003 in criminal activity, and since these issues were never developed in the district court.
Correct, Your Honor.
I mean, the theory that he just sort of on February 26th, was it, kind of instantly became the trusted, reliable right-hand man and enforcer of Mr. Howard seems a little improbable.
We're certainly not arguing that on that day, the day the wiretaps started, he all of a sudden showed up and was part of this conspiracy. But the problem in this case is that he may have been involved prior, but the investigation had no evidence that he was involved with these particular people at that time, and they had been conducting extensive surveillance. He was not in any photographs. He had not been observed. The main investigator that testified couldn't identify his voice until he listened to the phone calls and then saw Mr. Jackson show up after the phone calls. So there's really scant evidence that he was involved in this conspiracy. And he did make some comments about being involved in criminal activity, but the connection, the nexus between this conspiracy and his criminal activity was just not shown at trial.
Well, it didn't have to be shown at trial.
Well,
and of course, there was no objection
at
sentencing to any of these things.
Correct.
Where presumably if he and his counsel had thought this was unjust, it would have been possible to say, no, wait a minute, I had nothing to do with those. I had no idea that these fellas from Gary were bringing down so much cocaine.
Right. The powder cocaine, the 42 kilograms, is a completely different a situation as far as the reasonable foreseeability, because there was no evidence that was even contemplated by the negotiations for this cocaine. That the negotiations were always about 3 kilograms, not any substantial amount more. But I'll address the plain error issue because I think that is, of course, the first hurdle in this case.
Waiver's a hurdle.
Waiver versus forfeiture and then plain error. In most situations where you have a defendant who raises no challenges and actually admits to the guideline range at sentencing, I think that I would say that that was a waiver. In this case, like the Jaime case that's cited in both of our briefs, there's no logical reason to not object. It's a record devoid of reason to not object to these
unless
two.
It's true.
Well, of course, unless it's true. But in most cases, the failure to object to something that's questionable is because the defendant does not want to risk acceptance of responsibility, which was not an issue in this case because Mr. Jackson went to trial and was 99% unlikely to get acceptance of responsibility. And with particularly the 42 kilograms, the 510 grams may be more arguable, but the 42 kilograms that nobody knew was coming with the 3 kilograms they ordered is too far in this case and should have been questioned, like the enhancement in the Jaime case.
So, what is the criminal history in Indianapolis? What's what's referred to in that statement?
My understanding is that he said that he was involved. He has got some prior convictions for gun offenses at that time. I'm not remembering the exact statement of his involvement.
But was the context a discussion about the items in his criminal history, or was the context a discussion about the relevant conduct?
I believe it was discussion upon his arrest. So it was not necessarily involved with either one.
Well, he did say at sentencing that his criminal history didn't start until 2003 when he arrived in Indianapolis, didn't he?
Right, and he said that when he was 27, he started. But that was in his allocution about getting involved in the wrong group of people and becoming involved. He wasn't specific about how that involvement was related to the conspiracy versus his own personal criminal involvement. It was,
how does the statement that he made at sentencing differ from what he said upon his arrest, or doesn't it?
I'm not sure off the top of my head. I don't think it does significantly differ. I'm not sure the record is entirely clear on that.
It's just ambiguous what he's talking about.
Correct. And I think it's part of a bigger, it's an allocution, so it's not necessarily legal argument. It's part of his bigger explanation for getting involved in the offense and demonstration of how he had turned his life around after his arrest in this case, and pleading for mercy from the court, as most allocutions are. Explaining his behavior, not necessarily talking about relevant conduct or criminal history as the guidelines contemplated. The government cites cases regarding the 510 grams of crack cocaine that conspiracy actions that happen before the defendant is involved in a conspiracy can be held he can be held accountable for them. However, again, even if he was in the background, he took no affirmative steps that are in evidence in this case to promote the conspiracy prior to his involvement. The date of his involvement, of course, is not known. It's definite in February and can be assumed at least partly beforehand. But, like I said, there's no evidence that he was involved for the first 6 months. In Gray Bay versus United States, this court held that acts before the defendant was involved are relevant conduct, but if he was involved from the early stages of the conspiracy, and there's certainly not evidence of that in this case. Again, the 42 kilograms of cocaine is a very interesting question in this case. If the guidelines give some examples like this, such as wholesale pornography distributors, that purchasers cannot be held accountable for the entire amount, this would be caused the government to perhaps reach all the way back to the original source of cocaine and hold the endpoint individuals responsible for all of that, and that in this it would be too much. And 42 kilograms was never contemplated in this case.
Counsel, let me ask you this. At best, from your position, we're operating under the rubric of plain error.
Correct.
There was some terrible plain oversight the district judge failed to take, right? When the district judge gets a pre-sentence report that scores out the way this one did, and the defense says no objection, what is the district judge supposed to do?
Well,
what
Your
error
Honor,
did he make?
In plain error situations like this, I'm not so sure that it's the district court's error. The error is simply the inclusion of the drug amounts and the relevant conduct. The error is that the defendant didn't raise it, or not the plain error, but there is an error that the defendant didn't raise it, and that's the problem.
Well, maybe. I mean, we don't know if the issue had been raised, we don't know what evidence might have been presented, do we?
Correct. We don't know. In this case, it's a little easier than in a guilty plea because we do have all the evidence from trial.
Sure, but you know that the government can get a conviction with much narrower, more targeted proof than the proof it might be able to put on about relevant conduct at sentencing.
Certainly. I think in the pre-sentence report, the problems with the way the drugs are added up, it should have alerted someone.
Well, the numbers were right, right?
Well, the numbers were right if you disregard the whole the situation, the numbers were added correctly. But if you talk about reasonable foreseeability and in furtherance of, the 42 kilograms is a red flag, I would think, to anyone reviewing a pre-sentence report where you have a relatively, I mean, it's a conspiracy, but it's a relatively small conspiracy, and then all of a sudden you have 42 kilograms of cocaine caught in a car driving away from the last drop in the conspiracy. And I see that I'm in my, actually, I think my time is up. So thank you, Your Honors. I urge you to reverse and remand for resentencing. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. McCoskey.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. Will McCoskey, Assistant U.S. Attorney. This Court should affirm the judgment, and Mr. Jackson's sentence should stand. Not surprisingly, I have a little bit of a disagreement with counsel about whether or not waiver applies here. It does. Mr. Jackson, it's not disputed. Mr. Jackson, with the assistance of counsel, had the opportunity to review the PSR before his sentencing hearing, which he, of course, confirmed at the sentencing hearing. He also had the opportunity at the sentencing hearing when prompted by the judge twice to correct any what he saw might be errors in the PSR, to include, and the district judge referred Mr. Jackson to this specifically, the paragraphs that contain the calculations that give rise to the base offense level, and that includes the drug quantities. So he had an opportunity. He let it go by.
But the judge didn't specifically phrase the question in terms of the drug quantities. It was in terms of the overall calculation of the range, right?
Judge, it was a range of paragraph numbers, Your Honor. And if you go back and look at the PSR, and I can, Judge, I'm happy to refer you directly.
No,
to
I
that.
Have that. Okay. I know that the judge phrased the question in terms of paragraph numbers in the PSR, which corresponded to the calculation of the base offense level.
Yes.
And then the total offense level.
Yes.
But the judge did not draw the defendant's attention to the drug quantity amounts, and I think the argument that Ms. Christensen makes is that the quantities were so large, the quantity that was added from the time period after his arrest, the 42 kilograms, and then the amount before any evidence of his involvement, that should have, special mention should have been made of that, I think is the argument, because it affected the range so significantly.
Yes, Your Honor, I agree. I'd like to go back to what Judge Hamilton mentioned, however. You know, the PSR, when the district judge gets a PSR, defense counsel gets it, the defendant gets it, the offense conduct in the PSR had these quantities. That's the first thing. The second thing, Your Honor, when the assistant U.S. attorney got up to make the arguments during sentencing, Mr. Glickman, he mentioned these amounts specifically. Again, silence from the defense. No objection. The defendant, through his counsel, even appeared to accept. I think the word he used was this. Yeah, that's the black and white calculation. We understand how you get to that number, the base offense level, which comes from the paragraph that the district judge referred to. And then finally, and you know, maybe most damning as far as waiver for Mr. Jackson, Mr. Jackson addressed the court in the allocution and had yet another opportunity to step forward and say, wait a minute, you know, that's a lot of dope. I had nothing to do with that. I challenge that. He didn't do it. Instead, he made what is a somewhat ambiguous statement, Judge Sykes pointed out, about when his criminal history started in Indianapolis. And the exact quote, actually, Your Honor, is, and I think this places it into context, my criminal history didn't start until 2003 till I got to Indianapolis. I did not know those guys in Gary. I met them when I got here. And that's on page 20 of the sentencing transcript. And, of course, those guys in Gary, his co-defendants in the charge conspiracy, Mr. Beeks, the two individuals who brought down, yes, admittedly, a very large shipment of cocaine that came down and the subject of course, much dispute with defense. But the fact is, as far as waiver goes, Mr. Jackson had multiple opportunities to lodge some sort of objection and make that clear to the district court that he's challenging this. He didn't do so.
What other evidence was there in his statement or otherwise of his involvement before he was captured on the wiretap?
Well, Your Honor, it is true that Mr. Jackson did not come to the attention of law enforcement in this investigation until we came up on the wire in February of 2005. That's the first time that we were able to identify him as a member. The evidence at trial that was presented, and I understand that defense counsel doesn't agree with this or appellate counsel doesn't agree with this, but the controlled buys that were carried out by Mr. Demetrius Brown that gave rise to the over 500 grams of cocaine base of crack that are at issue and that was attributed to Mr. Jackson. The very first call that was played in the February 2005 call that was played for the jury was a call between Demetrius Brown and Mr. Jackson, and they spoke basically in code. They set up a drug deal using code. And the context of the call, and it's it would be the sentencing transcript, Your Honor, I'm sorry, the trial transcript at 72 to 75, pages 72 to 75, where they use code, and I think the jury was entitled to make the reasonable assumption based on the context of two people who know what they're talking about and are that they've dealt with each other previously. And not only was the jury entitled to make that finding, more importantly for our purposes, the district court was entitled to make that finding in the context of sentencing and made that finding in adopting the offense conduct, again, in the PSR, without objection from Mr. Jackson.
Counsel, could I ask, there doesn't seem to be any dispute that the defendant here was involved in at least personally with several kilograms of cocaine that was being delivered. Is it a reasonable assumption it was being delivered for cooking into crack?
Your Honor, certainly the scope of the conspiracy includes cocaine that was transferred from Gary to Indianapolis that was cooked into crack, but not necessarily all.
And not all.
Go ahead. I'm taking this from the PSR specifically that was adopted by the district court where it doesn't specifically say that all of it was cooked into crack.
Right. But here's, I guess, my concern, and this is when we're dealing with this kind of what-if land of plain error. Generally, the practice is if it's still powder when it's seized, it's treated as powder, even if the intention clearly within the conspiracy would have been to cook it into crack and drive the guideline ranges sky high. If this issue had been presented at the trial court, what would the government have done in response?
Your Honor, I didn't try the case, and of course I'm as familiar with the record as I presume the court is, so I don't want to speculate as to what the government would have argued if it's something that's not in the record. I don't know, Your Honor, what you would like me to address in that respect.
I don't know. I know Mr. Glickman appeared before me in many, many cases in sentencings, and was unlikely to go down without a fight if he had evidence, if the objection had been raised.
So. Well, Your Honor, if I may, I think that brings up another fact about waiver that's important for this court's consideration. Waiver, of course, not only protects this court's time and resources when something should have been litigated below, it protects the other party, in this case the United States. I don't know, Judge Hamilton, what Mr. Glickman would have done, but I'm quite certain that we wouldn't have just sat there, the United States would have just sat there if there's an objection and not try to bring forward something, if there is something, to substantiate relevant conduct that goes beyond what was in the PSR that was adopted by the district court. That's the best I can do on that, Your Honor, but I will say that, again, that highlights the importance of enforcing a waiver doctrine at the Court of Appeals level. With respect to if we get to the merits of you know, whether or not plain error should apply here, again, this is not a case where there's some miscarriage of justice given the lack of objection. I understand that kind of goes back to the waiver issue. But on the other hand, overwhelming evidence was presented at the trial to the jury, which, of course, a trial that this district judge presided over, but overwhelming evidence that showed that Mr. Jackson was substantially involved in this conspiracy, a conspiracy that swept or entailed Gary players and Indianapolis players, but substantially involved not only as a top lieutenant, but as an enforcer, as a distributor, as somebody that clearly had an understanding of what the full scope of the conspiracy was.
For all of 2004?
Well, Your Honor, as I say, those calls show that the reasonable assumption could be made, and I think the jury did make this assumption, and so did the district court, that Mr. Jackson had some level of involvement, certainly more than just springing to life in February of 2005 when it was just fortuitous that the government came up on the intercepted calls. He had involvement. He spoke with Mr. Brown, Demetrius Brown, again, as if they were players, and they were players.
Well, you got wiretaps on this conspiracy for all of 2004, right?
Starting in 2005, Your Honor.
Oh,
the
not
controlled
all of 2004.
Buys were in 2004.
Yeah, you were only up for about 60 days, weren't you, on the wire?
I think that's right, Your Honor. Once they identified that another load, that several loads were coming down from Gary, and they intercepted those.
Could I just ask one quick follow-up? Bowen and Williams were the two guys who had the 45 kilos in their car?
Yes, Your Honor.
Were they named co-conspirators?
Just looking at the PSR, they were named co-conspirators in count one in the conspiracy count.
Thank you.
Thank you. Court should affirm, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Christensen, you had run out of time, but I'll give you a minute to rebut if you have anything further you'd like to say.
I'll just quickly note that, you know, this is an interesting pre-sentence report in a lot of ways, and one of them is that there's usually a government's version of the offense attached to it, and there's not. And usually that provides the government's basis for all of the relevant conduct.
You mean a separate document?
Well, I take from all districts.
The Southern District
does not
use a separate document ever.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. There in other districts there usually is. There's usually the probation officer usually has reviewed something that the government has submitted to them, obviously. And my assumption is that should be in the pre-sentence report. And the fact that there is not that evidence in the record that we have on appeal is a detriment to this court. Of course, we acknowledge if there had been objection, we would be in a much better stance to make this argument. However, when it's such a large red flag, particularly the 42 kilograms, we believe that that meets the forfeited rather than waived, and that this case is reversible plain error.
Can I ask a question? Where does the detail about the different categories of drugs that were quantified for purposes of the base offense level?
In the pre-sentence report?
The paragraphs in question don't really provide any of the detail. It just says totals.
Right. The paragraphs, I think it's 36 through 46, are the actual calculations. The paragraphs preceding that about offense conduct, there are dates listed, and each date is either a controlled by or conversation. And there's not a calculation until you get to our briefs. There's one in our factual statement. The government also has done one. And that would have been very helpful in this case. I'm hesitant to, of course, blame a probation officer for not doing that, where it might have been defense counsel's burden. But it would have been more helpful in this case because it's a murky record.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.